Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Inflation, that's something we haven't had to think about for years. Some younger people have never experienced inflation. Well, they're experiencing it now. We all are. Prices for just about everything have been rising for months. Groceries and gasoline are just some of the things we buy that are giving us sticker shock. Inflation is at its highest rate since the 1980s, 40 years ago. You're paying 7% on average, more than what you're used to, and that means if you got a 5% raise last year, you're making less because you're paying more. Why is this happening? How much longer will this go on? How much higher can prices go? And when will they start to come down? Here to explain it all and give us an update on the general economy and on yesterday's stock market roller coaster ride, we have three economists with us. Mark Bittner is managing director and senior economist at Wells Fargo. Welcome back.
Be here.
Dr. Vikram Kumar is professor of economics at Davidson College. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mike.
And Dr. John Connaughton's back with us. He's professor of financial economics at UNC Charlotte's Belt College of Business and director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. Good to see you as well. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Mark, in the fall of last year, I think it was October, the Federal Reserve was predicting inflation of 2% over time. That prediction came at a time when gasoline prices were already up 43% over the previous year, and beef prices had already risen by 12%. And it was at the same time that the London-based research firm Capital Economics predicted that the United States might be heading into an era in which inflation remains significantly higher on average over the next decade. So you've called this trend pernicious. First, how did the Fed get it so wrong? And which of those two predictions do you think will be the closer reality over time?
Well, I think the Fed got it wrong because they had been so good at containing inflation for so long, and they were believing the headlines. Because what we heard from the Fed over and over again was that as long as inflation expectations remain contained, meaning that as long as people expected inflation not to become a problem, that if we had some sort of short-term flare-up, it would quickly self-correct. And this is a part of what's known as New Keynesian economics, and virtually everyone at the Fed is a New Keynesian. There's a lot more to it than that, but I thought that was wrong-headed from the start. And I think what Capital Economics was looking at is the same thing we've been looking at, which is this inflation is the real deal. It was caused by an incredibly expansive fiscal policy that was accommodated by an incredibly expansive monetary policy. And it's the worst possible combination of policy in regards to generating inflation.
And so before we get a definition of what those two policies are, were they necessary in your mind?
They were necessary at the start of the pandemic. They were not necessary a year ago. And we continued them. Unfortunately, we were in an election year, and so there was a lot of pressure to get something done before the election and then right after the election. And really, I think the best analogy is it's sort of like pouring lighter fluid on a campfire and hoping that the wood's going to catch. And we poured so much lighter fluid, we threw the match on it, and it flared up. And that's all we got was the flare-up.
We got
a little bit more than that.
John, Dr. Connaughton, give us a definition of those two policies that Mark referred to and how they, what they were meant to do and how they actually act within the economy at large.
Okay, so during the first year from spring of 2020 through spring of 2021, the Congress and the President, both administrations, signed into legislation essentially $5 trillion of deficit spending to deal with the downturn caused by the COVID virus. To put that in perspective, that $5 trillion in a year's period of time is about 23% of US GDP at the time. So that they increased spending to compensate for a lack of GDP by 23%, but real GDP only went down by 3%, 3.4% in 2020, excuse me. In addition to that, we had the average American family, two adults, one child, got $8,900 of stimulus checks during the year. That's 14% of the average household income. So all of this is excess demand essentially thrown into the mix. At the same time, what was happening was the Fed was accommodating that deficit spending. The Congress and the president, fiscal policy, could spend whatever they want and have no impact on inflation, interest rates, excuse me, because the Fed accommodated them by buying up the bonds that the Fed was issuing. The Federal Reserve balance sheet went from $3.7 trillion at the beginning of this to today it's $8.7 trillion. You take the difference, that's $5 trillion. They effectively bought up the entire debt that Congress and the president passed and signed into law. So that's really what Mark's talking about here. Totally unnecessary. The stimulus package probably was 7 to 8 times what the previous largest stimulus package was. Totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary.
Wow.
Sounded good at the time, made everybody happy. Everybody was scared. But from an economic standpoint, it was what fueled inflation.
So they're reacting to the pandemic and the economic, the closure of business and the layoffs of millions of workers. And they were trying to stave that off and pump money into the economy and keep individuals and in some cases businesses afloat during all that. Maybe they overdid it, Dr. Kumar. But the question is, would this inflationary period that we're experiencing now, it would not have come about without the pandemic and the reaction to the pandemic? Because we've been in a non-inflationary period for, what, about 40 years now?
Yeah. And in fact, just prior to the pandemic, the economy was just going great guns. I mean, it was humming along. It was, you know, unemployment was the lowest since 1969, you know, across all categories of American workers, by race, by education. So the economy itself was very strong. The Federal Reserve had tried to raise interest rates to get out of, you know, its post-global financial crisis policy stance. So it was trying to wean itself away from that when the pandemic happened. And the pandemic was a black swan event. I mean, it was, you know, of an order of magnitude in terms of just its characteristics and its impact that was just shocking. And there was really not a good playbook. So a lot of the work, policy work that was being done, you know, by the sort of seat of one's pants, if I may put it like that. So the supply constraints were very much a part of, like, you know, the impact, you know, people staying home for fear of infection, you know, school disruptions, keeping parents home, all sorts of things, and supply chain disruptions. So the supply shocks were very, very significant. Like you know, Mark and John have said, you know, the policy mix was just hugely expansionary, you know, because people had sort of thought about the global financial crisis. And, you know, at that time, there was some concern that fiscal policy had not been sufficiently expansive, and that had, you know, had negative consequences for emerging from the global financial crisis. So the idea here was to just put in as much stimulus support as possible. So I think that those were sort of, that was a thinking. But once inflation began to appear, I think that the Fed had a much harder task of trying to figure out what it was. I agree with Mark to some extent, but I think it was also that the Fed, you know, by constantly saying that inflation was transitory, I think it was trying to shape expectations as well. So it was trying to, like, contain expectations by talking it down. And when that didn't actually materialize, then the Fed, of course, had to do a pivot, you know, in the last month and a half. So I think that is how it has evolved. I think it's been a difficult situation for the Fed. There's no question about it. At this point, I'm not convinced that the Fed thinks that, you know, inflation is in fact a real problem. And we can talk about that.
Okay. We're also going to talk about the last time we were in an inflationary period, which was 40 years ago. But Mark, for 40 years, we have subdued the beast, and we're not accustomed to any of this. How unusual is it to be in a period where inflation is pretty much not of no consequence for 40 years? How unusual is that?
It's unusual for a lot of folks that weren't around. I started in this business at the tail end of the late 70s, early 80s inflation. And one of the things that I've been telling people about that period is that we didn't just suddenly go from high inflation to this benign environment. It took the Fed 15 to 20 years to bring inflation down from 4% to 2% on a sustained basis. And so I really cringed every time I heard the word transitory, because I said it's not supply chain bottlenecks. Supply chain bottlenecks are a consequence of higher inflation. They're a consequence and a byproduct of high inflation. They're not the cause of it, and it's not temporary. And I think that right now the financial markets are getting out of kilter because they think the Fed is going to suddenly shock the economy back into 2% inflation. And it's more likely to be a marathon, not a sprint. It's going to take quite some time to bring inflation back down to 2%. And I'm thinking the latter part of this decade, if we do everything right.
John, the pandemic was an extraordinary event. Most of us have never lived through anything like it. And we lost millions of jobs, and businesses shuttered temporarily, and some of them shuttered permanently. The supply chain was grossly disrupted here and around the world, throwing everything out of whack. And yet, we kept being told in the deepest part of this by economists and people in the government that we're supposed to trust, that this too shall pass, that when we start emerging from our cocoons and going back to normal, everything would go back to normal, including the prices. And that has not proven to be the case. Were they naive?
First of all, let me comment on what Mark said. Now, you know, Mike, that Mark and I don't necessarily agree very often. But unfortunately, I think what Mark said at the very end, that this is not going away anytime soon, is unfortunately very correct. I think Mark's right that we're going to be dealing with this for several years, maybe for the entire decade of the 20s. So that's number one. Number two, I'll go back to kind of what you said about the decline and a couple of things that just kind of clean up. What one was, there was a real sharp drop in the second quarter, real GDP in the U.S., over 30%. But in the third quarter, most of it was recovered. It was, pretty much over by then. Yeah, it took a little while for the unemployment rate to get back down, but it was steadily dropping after July of 2020 by several points every single month. Okay, so that's number one. And that's why I say that the response by fiscal policy response and the monetary policy response were completely out of line given the circumstances. We knew by the summer of 2020 that this was A, over, and B, on the mend. Now, the second point you mentioned is the number of businesses that supposedly went out of business. And I'm sure that several businesses went out of business and were not able to reopen. But when you start to look at the data, what you find is, gee whizzikers, there are more businesses today, more establishments, physical places of business today in North Carolina than there were before this all began. Okay, so we went through a dip where some businesses failed and businesses went out in 2020. But by 2021, this was done. We were, in fact, creating new businesses on a regular basis.
So the question then becomes, why we're still in this, why prices are up and continue to rise. And I want to hear from Dr. Kumar also about whether or not he agrees with Mark Vittner and you about this going on for the next decade and what he thinks that number may be through the next decade. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy, most specifically about inflation, something that many of us have not had to endure for about 40 years. And that means there are a lot of younger people out there who have never experienced anything like this. And they're wondering, why? What's going on? We're trying to get an explanation from three economists. Mark Vittner is managing director and senior economist at Wells Fargo. Dr. Vikram Kumar is professor of economics at Davidson College, and Dr. John Connaughton is professor of financial economics and director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. One of the comments we've gotten while we've been talking comes from Greg on Facebook. He says, my rent went up 15% this year, same for internet service, with no upgrades. In other words, he's getting nothing for his money that he's paying more for now. And so I want to get from Dr. Kumar whether or not you agree with the fact that John Connaughton just said this inflationary cycle is going to be with us for the rest of the decade. And if so, what do you see the inflationary number being over time? And why is this happening now that things have gone back to normal?
Well, first of all, I don't mind making forecasts for 10 years out because nobody's going to be there to check.
No one's going to remember.
Exactly. There is a case to be made for what both John and Mark have said, but I do agree that there are forces at play that will make, you know, prices higher in general going into the future. But, you know, as to inflation, some of that is going to depend upon how skillfully the Federal Reserve executes its policy mandate now. I mean, if it is able to adjust expectations quickly, if it is able to, get a, handle on the economy quickly, then there is a possibility that, the trajectory of inflation may not be quite as bad as one might think. But the surprising thing is the confounding thing is that the Federal Reserve is not acting with sufficient intensity and, haste. I mean, it is still expanding its balance sheet. It's going to be, buying security is going to be expanding its balance sheet through next month. And some of that, I think, it has to do with the Fed boxing itself in because it had, provided forward guidance. It had statement of intent. So, to retain its credibility, it has to follow through on what it has said. But I'm surprised that the Federal Reserve is still, has an expansionary stance, into March when, inflation has been about 7% for 2 months.
Is that why you said before the program started that you are a little skeptical? I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but you're skeptical of the people in charge's ability to handle this?
Well, I have the greatest respect for, the intellectual firepower at the Federal Reserve. There's no question about that. But the problem is that, there might be, I think the modeling that, is done, the models depend upon, patterns emerging and re-emerging so that we can draw lessons from the past and then forecast the future. This has been such, idiosyncratic events. It has been such a unusual event that I think that there's no sort of playbook to even make good forecasts. So, maybe the Fed actually believes this. I'm not doubting the Federal Reserve. I'm just saying that institutionally, the conclusions that it is coming to, it has not explained itself well. And yeah, its actions don't seem to jive as well with its, with its statements.
So, John, we just heard from Mark, who said his rent has gone up 15%, and as has his internet bill for no more. He's getting nothing for that extra money. The place where most consumers are seeing the impact of this is in rent, particularly in Charlotte, and it's also at the grocery store and at the gas pump. And you have said that in Charlotte, we may have suffered less than other places with regard to grocery prices, because of supermarket competition. Well, heck, we have 100 million apartments here that we didn't have last year. So why isn't that the same thing?
Well, let me just comment, first of all, what Vikram said. He has a respect for the intellectual power of the members of the Fed. I do as well. But I don't think this is about intellectual power prowess. I think this is about position. And I think the Fed is not as interested in inflation as it is in some other issues. And I think that's really part of the problem here. And also, Mike, for the last year, we've had essentially an empty Federal Reserve Board of Governors. We've had at least three seats vacant. Now I think we have four seats. Vikram, am I right? We now have four seats vacant?
I'm not sure. I think I thought it was three, but it may be.
Okay. I thought with recent retirements, it was four. But my point is that we don't have the full chorus and the full diversity on the Fed right now to provide alternative opinions. What Vikram said is very, very true. The fact that the Fed has still not tapered its bond buying, what I would call habit, okay, is telling. Secondly, okay, the Fed is talking about potentially three rate hikes. Mike, at the end of the year, if they do three rate hikes, the federal funds rate won't be zero, it'll be 0.75%. It's still going to be negative 4, 5, 6% interest rate. That is not fighting inflation, okay? They've shown no interest in actually doing anything but responding to criticism. So in terms of your caller's concern, this is not the last time that he or she is going to hear or experience increases in prices.
So you're saying that they're not doing enough. And if they're not doing enough, if they do what you guys would, and I don't know, Mark, if you're on the same page with John Connaughton, but if you are, if they're not doing enough, were they to do enough, like raise interest rates, wouldn't that drive prices up even higher?
Well, it would not drive prices up higher, but it would run the risk of stalling the economic recovery. And what concerns me about the Fed is that I don't think they have the political independence that they did under Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker. And so they're not likely to push as hard as they would have if they did.
Well, the Fed is not a governmental body. So why don't they have that independence? Because that's the way it was set up.
The Federal Reserve Board is governmental, but it's supposed to have independence. But you know, as it is, people, you know, we've had vacancies for a long time, and you have to have Senate approval. And we're likely to add three dovish members, and we've added more dovish members to the Fed. So it's never really been as independent as we'd like, but it's become less independent.
I'm going to ask Dr. Kumar an uncomfortable question, and I'll come back to you, Mark. And that is the fact that he just said that we have three dovish members in waiting, I suppose. Is one of those dovish members of the Fed the professor from Davidson who has been nominated by President Biden?
Well, my department colleague and my dean of faculty, Philip Jefferson, has been nominated. I'm sure that he is going to get confirmed. I would not assume anything on part of Philip. I think he's, very intellectually soundly grounded. I'm not going to, put words in his mouth. I'm not going to, speak for him, but I think that he is going to look at the totality of things. I think he understands well the cost that inflation inflicts across the board, and it can be severe. And I think that, once the Fed governors are nominated, confirmed, they have a 14-year tenure. Yeah. So I think that they are insulated, in some sense. I'm not saying that the Fed, is going to, hang up its spurs and retire from the inflation game. That is absolutely not, what I expect. I'm a little confounded. I'm not saying that I'm convinced that the Fed has given up on it. But it hasn't explained its position as well as it should. Political pressures always, surround policy institutions. There's no question about it. And I think that is going to be something that the Fed will have to be clear about, because going into later in the year, the Fed might have to take even stronger measures that may be more unpalatable, you know, to the economy at a time when the elections are going to be around the corner. So it might face significant political pressure, but then that is going to be a test, you know, of the Fed's ability and its intent. So the Fed has to, you know, basically what's happened is for the last 10 years, the Federal Reserve has been in an easing mode. And easing is like, everybody likes it, you know, if you don't create bad things. So the Fed has had no pushback on anything it has done. So I think it is kind of out of practice in some, at some level. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting. I think that there's going to be some, you know, navigation that's going to be required. I think there's going to be, you know, high level of negotiation, political negotiation that's going to be required. But hopefully the Fed is going to do the job.
So, Mark,
I was going to say that we want to have both hawks and doves at the Fed. I don't want to imply that being a dove is a bad thing at all. It's not.
And I interrupted you, and I wanted to give you a chance to finish if you even remember what you were talking about. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mike, may I just say something about the rent and the internet, you know, that your caller talked about? That is the reason why we need to, you know, there needs to be quick action on inflation, because as these decisions on price increases get folded in, it begins to build up this ratchet of wages and prices that are very hard to contain. So the quicker, you know, we actually douse the, you know, this fire, you know, the better off we're going to be.
So, Mark,
well, I wanted to add something on that, though, Mike, if I can. The persistence of zero interest rates is what's given rise to this increase in apartment rents. Because people that are buying apartments can borrow money at close to zero, and they are bidding up the prices of apartment communities, and they're having to raise rents in order to justify the higher prices that they're paying for that. And that's Charlotte is one of the hottest markets right now. And rents in Charlotte, you're lucky it's only up 15%, because metro-wide we're up 21%. And because of that, inflation in Charlotte is not 7%, it's closer to 10%. And I base that off of other metro areas that we get monthly CPI data for, in a similar position with rents.
So if you have the money for a down payment, that would normally drive people into the real estate market, because rents are becoming ridiculous and you're kind of not going to get that money back. But if you buy a house, you might. But the problem that with that in Charlotte, I would think, and in some other places around the country, is that the real estate market is also incredibly hot. It's a buyer's market and there's no place to go. There are very few homes for sale. Dr. Connaughton, that explains the raise in rents, but look at what we're buying. I mean, the price of automobiles has gone up because of the chip shortage, we are told, because the chip factories had to shut down during the pandemic, and that has resulted in not enough parts for computers that run these cars. That explains that, but why milk? Why bread? Why eggs? Why gasoline? There doesn't seem to be any shortage of any of those things.
Okay, I'm going to kind of piggyback on something Vikram said, and I just want to tie it all together, give the audience a little bit of a really short, condensed version of inflation. So we had demand pull inflation, which I talked about at the beginning of the show, brought about by sending out tons of money to people to bid up prices. And so that happened at the end of 2020 and into early 2021. Okay. And we saw the first kind of wave of demand pull inflation pop up in the spring of 2021, when we started to see 3-4% increases in prices year to year in May and June. Second type of inflation is cost push, which is what we're talking about these days with supply chain shortages causing costs to increase, labor shortages requiring businesses to bid up wages for, again, cost to increase and be passed on to consumers. So got demand pull, which was caused basically by government action. We have the follow-up of cost push inflation. Those are the two textbook definitions. And what Vikram had talked about was essentially what I call inflationary expectations. Once you get enough inflation cast into the economy, people then begin to think that, okay, prices rising is normal. Businesses can easily raise prices And if they don't get in on the game now, it's going to be difficult for them to raise it again. And so we've got all those things. And the worst thing right now, Mike, is what Vikram said, and that is we are now in that phase. We've passed demand pull and cost push. That's behind us. We're in the phase now where it's inflationary expectations are driving this.
Wow.
And that's the hardest one to curb, to be honest with you.
Well, that leads to the question that I asked before we started, and many of you poo-pooed it and said, don't go there. But we have a question from Charles on Twitter who's going there. So let's take it there. One cause of inflation, he says, is the monopolies, price gouging. For example, shipping lines. How does the largest go from, I'm not sure I understand how this is phrased, but how does the largest go from in good profit years, $1 billion, to now $24 billion, all while having performance issues in the supply chain? The costs will get passed on to the consumers. And Mark, that leads to this. If it's not companies making hay while the sun shines, raising prices, as John just said, because they have to, because if they miss this opportunity, they may not get another opportunity to make up for the losses they may or may not have experienced during the economic downturn. If that were just the case, if it was just prices going up for that, but profits are going up too. Corporate profits are going up. So isn't some of this needless?
I don't think that's the case. I mean, the reason why shipping costs have gone up is that the volume of goods that are being shipped has increased about 27% higher than it was prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, but that's volume, and volume usually causes things to go down in price.
No, I mean, if you've got more volume relative to capacity, that's what's demand pull inflation. And that's what we've seen in the logistics sector, where they're hard pressed for warehouse space, for trucks, for truckers, and warehouse workers, dock workers. Everybody's pressed against capacity, and it's because we had so much stimulus, and spending on goods completely recovered to its pre-recession level in May of 2020. So it fell for 2 months, and then it recovered in 2 months, and it's surged ever since. In addition to the chip shortage in automobiles, one of the things that's driven car prices higher is we've had this huge movement from New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA to places like Phoenix, Dallas, Atlanta, and Charlotte. So they moved from places where they didn't need a car to places that they absolutely needed a car, and that drove up the demand primarily for used cars. So we've seen some shifts. Now, what drove that migration was inflation. Because the one thing you can do in a high inflation economy to boost your standard of living is to move from a high cost area to a low cost area. We saw the exact same thing in the late 1970s and the early 1980s.
And with that, we have to stop. We'll come back in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about inflation and the economy with Dr. Vikram Kumar from Davidson College, Mark Bittner from Wells Fargo, and Dr. John Connaughton from UNC Charlotte. John, I was just talking to Mark about how prices are up, but so are corporate profits, and I'm just trying to get my head around this. If corporate profits are up, because prices are up, are these companies being greedy? Couldn't these prices come down if they eschewed some of the profit? Or is that just simply antithetical to capitalism?
Well, I think you're right on that last point, Mike. But I think there's something else that's going on here that I think that we need to think about. All right. And one of the things that's driving the conversation today is this whole idea of supply chain breakdown shortages. I keep hearing, you know, just comment on something that Mark said earlier about the Fed being afraid of chopping off this recovery. We're way past recovery. We're in the expansion phase. We have an unemployment rate below 4%. There's nobody's definition of full employment that isn't full employment. I mean, that's it. Now, you'll hear the counter argument. Well, we still have 2 or 3 million people that aren't in the labor force that were there before this all began. That's got nothing to do with COVID. This has been knowable. This has been on the horizon for a decade or more. I first started talking about labor force shortages at least 6 years ago in my quarterly forecast that I provide at the university. And it's a simple fact of demographics. And it's almost like deja vu all over again, if I can quote Yogi Berra here. The Fed was not, and the Congress was not paying attention to demographic changes and shifts in the 1970s when we had the last round of inflation. And they're not paying attention to it right now. So let me give you a quick analysis on this. So we look at demographic age groups in five-year cohorts. The people that are right now, we're in the middle of the baby boomers retiring. The baby boomers were the biggest generation. So we look at the people that are 60 to 65 years old today. There's more people in that number than there is in the 16 to 19 year olds that are going to replace them in the labor force. So the labor force is going to go down. It's going to decrease in size. That is a fact. So this fact that we're talking about, well, geez, wisdom, we've got, you know, 2 or 3 million fewer people in the labor force today than we did in December of 2019 was inevitable. It was going to happen. What COVID did to exacerbate this problem was push forward some of the retirement decisions that people, the baby boomers, were making. And that's just a fact. We're going to have to get used to this going forward. You know, there are only two things that create economic growth: increase in productivity and increase in labor force. And if you have one of them actually shrinking and the other fairly stagnant, that's increase in productivity, you're going to have a very low GDP growth in the future. Congressional Budget Office, I know they've caught a lot of grief in recent months, but they do a 10-year forecast. And if you look at their 10-year forecast, you'll see that forecast for the next 10 years does not have a single year above 2% in terms of real GDP growth, which is indicative of the realization that we are not going to have any labor force growth for the next decade. And we're going to have to adapt to that. So the idea that somehow or other fiscal or monetary policy is going to bring 2 million people back into the labor force who've retired is a fantasy.
So I want to get a little history lesson about how, in a second, about how we got rid of the super hyperinflation we had 40 years ago, and which resulted in this 40-year lull. But before we do that, here's an email from Andrew, Dr. Kumar, that I'd like to take a stab at. I'm hearing lots, he says, of talk about why prices are going up. But once things settle down, will we see prices drop? Or will grocers and landlords just fall back into the normal inflation and leave prices where they are? Historically speaking, when prices go up, do they ever come down?
No, pretty much not. That is very, very unlikely to happen. I mean, Andrew can, you know, best hope for prices, you know, moderating so that, you know, future increases are going to be palatable, you know, within a 0 to 2% range, you know, close to 2%, which the Fed has, you know, for a long time tried to target. But there is not a case that I can see where prices will in fact fall. And I don't think that's very good for the economy. That's what happened during the Great Depression. That's, you know, what we call deflation. That causes all kinds of negative disruptions in the economy. And so I think that that is not an outcome that one would wish to have.
So Mark, we're making less now, but despite any raises we may have gotten, if they were less than 7%, we're making less money than we made before. But because workers are demanding more money, and in many cases, employers are responding, isn't that also driving prices up, Mark?
Yes, absolutely.
I do.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I thought you said Mark. We are seeing a little bit of a wage price spiral, and but even though wages are going up, they're not keeping pace with inflation.
Right.
And that's when you reference that, I've used the term pernicious. That's one of the things that I think is very pernicious about the current inflation environment, is that real wages have actually fallen more over the last year than they did in the financial crisis.
So let's get a little history lesson here, Mark. Let's put in the inflation that we are currently experiencing into context, because it was, I think, twice as bad 40 years ago than it is right now. We had double-digit inflation rates in the 70s. In the 80s, as I mentioned before we started, I had a mortgage interest rate, a 30-year mortgage at 18%. Remind us, what kind of impact does that kind of inflation have on ordinary people and then the economy at large? And do you see any signs that we're heading toward that kind of inflation today?
Well, that kind of inflation was devastating. I mean, it makes it very hard to have any actual real economic growth. And everybody starts trying to figure out ways that they can minimize the impact of inflation on their personal life or in their business, and they're not focusing on growing their business. And it also adds to a lot of uncertainty. And unfortunately, it's folks at the lower end of the income spectrum that get hurt the most, because they spend most of their income. They, you know, upper income households can save some of their income by buying assets, which appreciate with inflation, but lower income households cannot. What helped bring inflation down is that the Federal Reserve clamped down on money growth very aggressively and threw us into the deepest recession that we had seen since the Great Depression. And the unemployment rate topped out at just under 11%. And it was a very long recession that lasted 18 months. And inflation for a short period of time came down to 2%, then it quickly rebounded to 4%, which it averaged through the end of the 1980s and into the early 1990s. And so it was after that that the Federal Reserve began a policy of what they call opportunistic disinflation, and that they would lean into the wind. When the economy was strong, they would tighten a little bit preemptively to help bring inflation down and kind of curb inflation on the way up, bring it down when the economy was slowing. And I think we need to see something similar, but the run rate on inflation, it may top out around double digit levels this year, but I don't think we're headed for a run rate as bad as we saw in the 80s. I think in this scenario, I think that inflation will be 3 to 5%, and the 3% will probably be when we get some relief on the supply chain disruptions, but that won't be the run rate. The run rate will be between 3 and 5%. And that's going to be what the Fed's going to have to work on later in the decade in order to bring back down to 2%, if they want to get back to their.
Yeah, and I think in the 80s, I think in the 80s, inflation topped out at 18%. One thing I know doesn't work is wearing those wind buttons that came out, whip inflation, now that President Ford came out with. That does not work. So let's not do that, John.
Mike, you got your decade wrong.
Okay.
Interest rates peaked out in the early 80s at 18%. That's for sure. But the decade of inflation was the 70s. Unlike Mark, who started his career just after that, I started my career during the 70s. We had a 10-year run of inflation running over 5% average during that period of time. But there were 3 years that it turned out to be double digit during that period of time. Volcker became Fed chair, and in October of 79, Volcker put his foot down and did essentially what Mark said, had very restrictive monetary policy that threw us into actually two recessions, a short one in 80 and then the big one that Mark talked about in 82, which essentially took the wind out of the sails, got out in front of the stampede, if you will. Real quickly, I think that, you know, the Fed has been disabling a lot of the controls that they've had during the past decade. We no longer have a reserve requirement for banks. It's zero, okay? It is. The Fed has gone into interest on excess reserves as their principal monetary tool to try to maintain. I think the Fed is wrongheaded on this. I think the Fed is in more trouble than we've indicated today in terms of their ability to do something about this. Mike, we have less than 4% rate of unemployment. By anyone's definition, that satisfies one of their dual mandates, and that is growing the economy, full employment. It's there. And yet they're still disregarding the inflation that's here. And I think they've run out of tools to deal with it. My big concern is not what Mark said. Mark's case, I think, is the best possible outcome. And that's a run rate somewhere between 3 and 5% over the next decade. I think there's a bigger downside risk in this, and that is that it gets out of hand during 2022 and the Fed does something to essentially spin us into a recession. And then I think what's going to happen is they're going to become very accommodative again, particularly during an election year, as Vikram had mentioned earlier. And unfortunately, we're going to wind up with a much higher run rate than what Mark suggests.
Dr. Kumar.
Yeah, well, John, you just said one thing on there. That first recession in 1980 was because Jimmy Carter blamed inflation on credit cards and put credit controls in place. So yeah. The Fed got the second recession.
Yeah, you know, you're right on that, Mark. And the other funny thing is that what really exacerbated inflation in the 70s was Richard Nixon coming out with wage and price freeze and then wage and price controls in 71, which was also another, you know, presidential edict or order or what have you.
So that president got a little, he was responsible for some bad things in the economy and elsewhere, of course, but and evidently so was Jimmy Carter. And now this president, President Biden, is getting a lot of flack from people who are giving him very low performance ratings, including his performance on the economy. And yet the economy's in good shape, it seems to me. We are almost no unemployment and things are recovering. Where people are hurting is inflation. And he has said, Dr. Kumar, that if the Build Back Better plan had passed, that would have helped. And he's hoping that the infrastructure bill that did pass will help. Will it, or is that going to simply overheat things?
Well, the infrastructure bill, I think that, you know, if it is executed prudently, is going to be helpful for the economy, but not for several years to come. I mean, it's not going to take effect right away. So it's not a panacea for our current situation. I think it is going to help economic growth in the future, but that is not, it's not going to have any impact on the current inflation, at least meaningfully.
Would the passage of the Build Back Better plan, which has a lot of social spending programs in it, would that help things or would it hurt things?
Well, it depends on help what and hurt what.
I think the economy, that inflation.
Well, it would not. In my opinion, is that it would have made inflation worse, just because of the way the revenue and the expenditures were structured,
okay,
and the amounts that were involved. But you know, people can have differences of opinion on that. I think the Congressional Budget Office, when it reviewed it, ultimately came out with the fact that it was going to have a significant impact on the budget deficit in the short run, and that was certainly going to be inflationary. So I think that goes back to how we began this program when Mark said that, you know, this is a very potent, strong mix of, you know, expansionary fiscal and monetary policies on the demand side that is, you know, exerting persistent pressure on spending, which is coming up against these supply constraints. So I think what the Fed has to do is to try to squeeze out some of this demand pressure. And that's a hard job. But it can do it. And I think that it can do it quickly. If it can do it quickly, it can, prevent this, this unwanted trajectory of inflation from crystallizing.
Okay, so I have 90 seconds left, and this Back to the Future trip into the 70s has all been a pleasant, unpleasant experience. When do you see it ending? Enough of this. Let's come back to the 21st century. What will our economy look like when this ends? When do you see it ending? Very quickly. And what will our pocketbooks be experiencing when we get this under control? Mark Bittner first, go.
Well, I think that we will see some relief on inflation in probably 23 or 24 when the supply chain disruption minimizes, but we're still going to be on this 3-5% trajectory on inflation up until we have the next recession, which hopefully won't be till 2026, 2027 or beyond then.
Quickly, John Connaughton.
I agree with Mark pretty much in his analysis, with one exception. I think the recession's coming sooner than what Mark would hope for. I think we're looking late 22, maybe 23 for a recession.
Splendid. And Dr. Kumar?
5% inflation by the end of this year.
Wow. JP emails, the dummy's guide to reducing inflation is as follows. Stop buying stuff you don't need and can't afford. There is some truth in that. I want to thank Mark Bittner being with us. He's Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo, Dr. Vikram Kumar, Professor of Economics at Davidson College, and Dr. John Connaughton, Professor of Economics at UNC Charlotte-Smith College of Business and the Director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. Thank you all for a fun hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.